1989 was an auspicious year for human freedom. In the spring, Chinese students occupied
Tiananmen Square,
erected a replica of the Statue of Liberty, and called for democracy and individual rights. By the fall, people living in East Germany took hammers and chisels to the Berlin Wall and pulled it down, unleashing a wave of revolutions that ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. 1989 was also the year that Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto published The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World, which radically challenged the conventional wisdom about the persistence of poverty in the post-colonial landscape.
This is what happens when people are helped by law instead of being obstructed by law.
De Soto argued that people were pushed into the black market and informal economy because governments refused to recognize, publicize, and promote legal ownership of property and other assets. Without clear title and the right to transfer property, common farmers and laborers understandably refused to invest in the land they tilled and the products they created, causing what De Soto later called the citadels of dead capital, whose riches could never be fully accessed. No one, he argued, would plan for the future in a world where everything you did or owned could just be taken away from you. An activist as much as an intellectual, De Soto has been called the world's most important living economist by former President Bill Clinton. He's credited with changing policy in Peru and elsewhere throughout the Southern Hemisphere, pushing governments to create property regimes that are public and transferable, thus giving people incentives to develop and build assets for the long term.
What works in the United States, the most successful, prosperous, and probably democratic country in the world, should be extendable to the rest of the universe.
His latest endeavor involves partnering with Overstock.com founder Patrick Byrne and others to use blockchain technology and social media to create totally public and perfectly transparent records of ownership. Reason caught up with De Soto in Washington this June, where he received the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Julian L. Simon Memorial Award, which is named for the late free market economist who believed that mankind is the ultimate resource.
Hernando De Soto, thanks for talking to Reason.
Great to be here, Nick. Thank you for inviting me.
You're in town to receive the Julian L. Simon Award. What do you see as the essential similarities between your thought and Julian Simon's? And then what are some of the big differences?
I would say that I'm a disciple of Julian Simon in a certain way, in the way that you pointed out about human beings being the ultimate resource. And that we're both probably disciples of, in part, Aristotle, who said that potential of anything is bigger than the thing itself. But the reason he said that for is because we could look at something and see its potential. Potential is how you see something being transformed into the future. And transformation is about combination, which would mean us being both disciples of de Tocqueville, who in his time also said that America was likely to succeed over everybody else or every other country because the art of combining was the highest here, as well as the laws for allowing things to be combined and therefore realize their potential. And therefore, it didn't matter what kind of the world, what part of the world you were in, you were always going to make a big deal out of it. You were always going to do something better because human beings can transform anything.
So how do you feel, if you're following American politics at all, we are now, and I guess this is also true in the European Union, there's this real sense that we are, you know, we have to close our borders. We're talking about putting up trade protection. Parties want to stop legal and illegal immigration. Is that a fundamental, kind of screw you to a longstanding, not just to an American ideal of open borders and welcoming people, but to the very genius that helped make America a wealthy country?
Well, I think it's disappointing. I think it's disappointing because I think that Westerners haven't quite realized what it, or remember what it took them to become great countries, or why Americans that came from other countries became great when they were in the United States. There were a bunch of institutions in the United States which allowed them to be great wherever they came from. And so one of the things that is crucial to doing something great is realizing, for example, that in the Middle East, there's a lot of people that could be doing business. I mean, they invented the check. They were much more prosperous than Westerners. until we decided to look at Islam instead of looking at whether they had the institutions to do so or not. They've got businesses like bazaars, and we don't look at them as, do they have limited liability? Can they get credit? Do they have property rights? They have none of those things. So here you've got business that also creates property. So it's a pity that we have now gone back to, instead of thinking about institutions, that is to say about civilizations, and rather come back to looking at cultures. Any culture can become prosperous, and it's disappointing in a way to see that the West is now concentrating on cultures instead of what it takes for a culture to be prosperous.
What do you think is the kind of reset button, you know, in the United States or in a society that starts going down a path to, you know, closing things off and not refreshing itself and not maintaining its institutions? What are the ways in which we can say, hey, look, stop that? How do we reset this conversation?
I think really talking about property rights. The thing is that they came in what de Gaulle would have called the Anglo-Saxon culture. They came through common law. Common law is judge-made law. It comes in little bits by little bits, and sometimes you forget where the trend is. But essentially, you learn to manage property privately, both as individuals and in collectiveness. A corporation is a collective. And if you go to developing countries and former Soviet countries, you will find that most people cannot access private property, that is to say, the capacity to identify something, locate it, and then transfer it. That doesn't exist in most of the world, as a result of which most of the world wants to come to the United States, and those in Africa and the Middle East want to come to Europe, and there you get all your protectionist policies and all your could have been avoided migration problems.
So, you know, your book, The Other Path, was published, or at least in English, in 1989, and that was a year that was fascinating for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which your book, but there was the Tiananmen Square protest and showdown, but the Berlin Wall was pulled down. How has your understanding of the need for transparent and transferable property rights changed your native Peru and Latin America? How has it affected other parts of the world? And is the spread of that kind of your basic insight that you were just talking about, is it really uneven throughout the world?
Well, it is uneven. The good side is that some people, like yourself, have obviously read me, and that's good. The trouble is that in my part of the world, the people that have read me the most are actually on the left. Mm. The left has understood that if most of us in the third world and the former Soviet Union are poor compared to you, it has to do something with property. So you will actually see that the people who go out and title in the Middle East, for example, and protect the ledgers that are homegrown about who owns what, it's the Islamic State, it's Al-Qaeda, it's the FARC, it's the Shining Path. The people that say they read Hayek, or they say they read Milton Friedman, or they say they read von Mises, in my part of the world, generally think about their property and other people's property. The guys who are thinking of also giving it to the poor so that they can prosper and not be a threat, at least for selfish reasons.
Are you optimistic about Latin America? I mean, in many ways, since 1990 or 1989, things seem to be better. The continent is more stable. Venezuela is a nightmare, but it's also that and Cuba are the last truly communist countries. So are you hopeful about your home region?
Well, yes, we have made progress. There is no doubt that we follow the traditional lines. We've got lower tariffs. We have more open borders, and therefore we have larger markets. There's no doubt about that. We're doing better. But we're still countries of mainly poor people. And poor poverty isn't, as we all know, a reason for revolting against the system unless you're not surrounded by poor people anymore and you're surrounded by some that are wealthier than you, then it becomes a problem. So now there's a second generation, if you want to, of inhabitants of Latin America who are those that are not so prosperous compared to those who did become prosperous. And I'm fortunate, I think there's still a majority. So there is some danger there. We still need further reforms. And they have a lot to do with who owns the assets and who can transform transfer them across borders, not so much who owns them, as whether you are actually certified to own them in such a way that you can be identified and cross the borders into larger markets. Yes.
In 2001, Reason was privileged enough to excerpt your book, Mystery of Capital. And in one passage, you talked about Cairo, Egypt, which has stayed with me since I first read it. And you talked about Cairo as a citadel of dead capital, you know, because it's this vast, you know, tomb of the once the greatest civilization on earth. And you wrote, "The institutions that give life to capital, that allow one to secure the interests of third parties with work and assets, do not exist here." What are those institutions besides, you know, I mean, there's the ownership, the title, transferability. How do you get a society? What will it take for Cairo or for Egypt to revive itself? And can it happen from within, or does it always happen from without?
No, it'll happen. It will happen if it comes from within. It's a big society. It's an old society. It's a wise society. Give you an idea of Cairo. About 70% of all assets in Cairo cannot be identified through any ledger. Who owns it? You don't know. Only about 14% of business organizations in Cairo are officially registered, and therefore have access to corporate law. What does that mean? It means not that you don't know people's addresses, because you do know where the addresses are. It doesn't mean that you don't know where the buildings are or the factories are. You do know where they are. It means they don't have limited liability, which is that means that every time they go and make a transaction, it's like a poker game where they have to put all their chips because they can't limit their liability. It also means that they can't get credit outside their neighborhood. Credit comes from credibility, and they're not credible outside a small part of the world. That means they have no economies of scale. What can you do when you don't have scale? It also means that they cannot pledge their assets. When you pledge, that's how you get investment. I get investment because I give you a title or a share to part of my wealth or my future wealth. So they've got none of the instruments to move ahead. And yet they've got all these bazaars, and they have actually a class that, in spite of all its limitations, all these this illegal sector, just the value of their buildings is about $340 billion. Now, when you talk about a rescue mission of the IMF to Egypt, and they say, "I think we're going to put in $2 billion," I mean, obviously, the assets that are needed are right there in the middle of Cairo. But for that, you have to be proud, decide to look at your own people in a non-traditional way.
So one of the most fascinating things I think that you're working on these days is the idea of using blockchain technology to create better, more transparent registries. You're working with people like Patrick Byrne of Overstock.com and other people who are really invested in you know, the possibilities of blockchain. How would that work, and how will that help kind of revive these, you know, kind of give CPR to these citadels of dead capital?
Well, the thing is that it's American technology. New technology can be a lot of help. Blockchain, simply because it can handle an enormous amount of information and use distributed ledger systems, and has platform contracts that are extremely useful. But it's not only that. It's, for example, what we recently just learned in Peru, in spite of the fact that it's been around for a long time, is that every time we had to communicate to people that they own things, but it would be a good idea to record them, and the simplified way is to actually take a canoe for the next four days and then record, etc., we now found out that we don't have to address them 4,000 or 5,000 at a time. I just addressed a whole bunch of them with one call using Facebook, and I addressed 2.5 million. Out of 30 million Peruvians, there's 18 million that actually have Facebook accounts. So we can put them on Google Map, and we can use Facebook, and you combine that with blockchain, we could get the whole place going in no time. We couldn't do that 5 years ago.
Does that, does the publicity of, you know, who owns what or what people are up to, does that also help limit the power of the state to, or powerful people to just unilaterally take what may or may not be theirs?
Yes, of course. The first thing, interestingly enough, that they don't like about blockchain, poor people, is that poor people don't want to hide what they own. They want other people to know that they own it and they shouldn't take it. So the fact of the matter, they, and to actually have a presence. So the fact is that being legitimate and be having a document is what gets you through. I mean, even now that I've come to visit the United States, the first thing I was asked as I got off the plane was, who are you? And they looked at my passport and checked it three or four times, had to put my four thumbs there. Once you got me identified, I could come into your country. Okay, most of the people in my country can't do that.
The idea then is using a distributed ledger, people will be able, you know, ownership will be public. And then how do you get to the point of transferability, though? Is that a, you know, and you were talking about transferring across borders and things like that. What kind of revolution? That's not really a technological revolution, right? That's more of a political or social revolution that people are allowed to own and transfer property freely.
Well, let's put it this way. We have discovered that all over the world, and you know, we who are not Europeans and are not North Americans are 90% of the world, have actually recorded our assets. But as opposed to yours, which are on the internet, are globally available and have been for some time, even before the internet, ours are not. So they are secured by local ledgers. That is to say that identification is local. So when Indiana Jones gets to the place he's supposed to go, he looks at the local ledger and he can identify everybody. But he couldn't have done that if he stayed back in Indiana. Right. Now, the thing, therefore, is that what you have to do is what MacArthur did when he went to Japan. He didn't go in and say everybody now can get titled according to the American system. He said, first of all, I want each of your individual ledgers, the ones that are guaranteed by local institutions in Japan, to record. Once these recorded and they're inside and they feel protected because they've come inside not only as individuals but protected by their institutions, then you start doing the titling because people feel safe. If you go, and that's why titling programs fail, generally when they come from the West, when you go and you say, I want to consider you as an individual that come from Guadalajara, Mexico, but I don't care about Guadalajara, come in by yourself, they won't come in because they've got to come in as institutions. Once they're in, then you do the demassification.
But that's a huge, I mean, you're asking the conqueror to be humble and to understand the local place rather than just tell everybody what to do.
Well, Napoleon did it. Mm-hmm. MacArthur did it. You forgot about it in Vietnam, and you forgot about it in the Middle East. Yeah. So remember MacArthur, remember Jefferson, remember Napoleon, and you'll see that the magic is easy.
Final question. When did you describe the moment when you had your kind of initial insights that that your country was not poor, that your people were not poor, and that it was the institutions or the failing of the structures around that trapped people in an active world, but not in a world where they could actually govern themselves and prosper?
Actually, it was when I closed a couple of books and opened my eyes. I had associated with some friends in putting a gold dredge in the Amazon. It was, I think, the first one.
And with a gold dredge, so it's you the water flows through and you pick up little bits.
No, it floats in the middle of the river and you just dredge. And we did it with some Bolivians and Rio Tinto zinc. Unfortunately, we did it just when the price of gold started coming down. But we didn't even really make money. We just ended up even. But I hadn't seen it because I'm not a miner. I just was in charge of trying to see if we could get some funds. And I brought in some of our funders. And we started going down the river, what was supposed to be our concession. It's a property right. And as we went down the river, we started seeing that there were some gold washing plants on the side. And I asked our manager, who are these guys? They're in our concession. He said, oh, these are called chichiqueros. These are, you know, like in the California gold rush, a bunch of guys with long beards and they're panning the gold and watching the gold. And they just kept on appearing as we kept on going down the river. And so our German investors had said, you know, why don't we kick them out if this is our place? And the manager, our manager, said, well, because at the dredge we're 50. And so far in our concession, we've calculated that there's 2,000 of these outlaws. Then I started realizing that most of us in the third world were outlaws. And then I started saying, what does it take to actually get a concession? And saw that we had took three law firms, a whole bunch of guys, and most Peruvians don't have three law firms and don't have the clout and don't have the contact. And that's when I realized that market economies weren't only just about freedom, they were about good institutions.
Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank you. We have been talking with Hernando de Soto. He is the author, of course, of The Other Path and the Mystery of Capital, and he's the 2018 award recipient of the Julian L. Simon Award, given annually by the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hernando de Soto, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.